From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, one of Michigan's tribal nations considers next steps as Line 5 moves forward.
It's been really dehumanizing. No one seems to value that these are our relatives and that we're being forced to unearth them and remove them for a private company.
Also, a brand new app to help answer your questions about Michigan plants in your neighborhood.
It's synthesizing most of what the website can do, and particularly most all of the things that you would want to have available in the field to identify a plant.
Then, a recent book explores a giant in the avant-garde literary scene, founded right here in Michigan.
In 1969, when we started the alternative press, we had never printed before in our life. We had to move the press into our basement in Detroit.
All that's coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Good to have you with us. Later this hour, we'll give you some background on a closely watched mayoral race that will be decided in less than a week.
And whenever you have the entirety of city council just standing up and voting in lockstep with the mayor, there's a problem. That's groupthink.
That's coming up in just a bit. But first, the company Enbridge is a step closer to building a new oil tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac for its Line 5 pipeline after the state of Michigan approved permits for the project last week. But let's back up a bit. Line 5 runs hundreds of miles from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario, and it carries more than 22 million gallons of drive oil and natural gas liquids every day. Since 2010, the company has been embroiled in a legal battle with the state and environmental advocates after an oil spill caused irreparable harm to areas of the Great Lakes and the Kalamazoo River. Now, the state has agreed to grant Enbridge this permit that would allow for the construction of a concrete tunnel along the straits to get it out of open water, but the construction could destroy historic and cultural resources, including the remains of tribal ancestors. Here to speak with us now is Whitney Gravel, president of the Bay Mills Indian Community and also an attorney whose practice involves federal Indian law. Whitney, welcome back to Stateside. It's good to have you.
Thank you. Ani Buju Giwede Nagabo Koyandishnakaz Ganushnakani Nindonjaba. My name is Whitney Gravel, and I currently serve as the president of Bay Mills Indian Community.
Let's start off with the straits themselves. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of this part of the lakes to the Bay Mills Indian community?
Yeah, the straits are really an important part of our oral tradition and have been centered in who we are as Anishinaabe in the Great Lakes since the beginning of time. We have creation stories that took place in the straits. It's how we understand who we are and how we came to be. And actually, a lot of the language associated with the straits is specifically tied to that creation story. We look at Mackinac Island or Fort Michilimackinac in Mackinac City. And what people don't realize is like Michilimackinac actually means the place of the great turtle. Mackinac Island is Turtle Island. And so all of these associated place markers really root ourselves in our understanding of creation taking place in the Straits area. And so when you look at that, you really realize the Straits is an epicenter of not only ceremony and culture and language, but also trade and economy and cultural resources. And that's exactly why there are so many cultural resources in the area, because our people have been gathering at the Straits to do all of these things since the beginning of time.
The state's permit acknowledges potential destruction of historic and cultural resources. That was the first piece of this that brought me up short. I mean, how is that even possible under the codes that the federal government has created to recognize its agreements with tribes?
Yeah, it's a lack of disregard regarding the treaty right and how culture and language are also associated with the treaty right. And that's been something we've been trying to teach the state and the federal government for the better part of a decade now. When people think of treaty rights, they think of the right to fish, the right to hunt, the right to gather. But the treaty language itself, specifically Bay Mills Indian Communities Treaty, which is the 1836 Treaty of Washington, the language preserved in that treaty is the usual privileges of occupancy. And so when you break down that language, what does occupancy mean? what does it mean to occupy land? It's really the ability to live an indigenous way of life. So yes, it does include the right to fish, hunt, and gather, but it includes so much more. And there was an elder that shared with me and imparted wisdom when we were talking about the treaty rights. He said, the treaty right to fish is the right to sing with fish and laugh with fish and dance with fish. What he was saying is absolutely true, because you're not only learning how to fish and putting fish on the table to eat, but you're bringing that fish to ceremony, or you're bringing that fish to events within your community, or you're learning about fish and stories from your elders at the dinner table. And so it's very much encompassed into an Indigenous way of life.
I am curious about what you can tell us about burial sites for ancestors in the land that this permit would cover. Anybody who knows anything about construction knows that if something is found, generally all work has to stop immediately because of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. How is this not overstepping that established federal policy?
It absolutely is, and it's overstepping it in a very designed and calculated way, because we have done the work where we know where those ancestors are buried now. And what is being proposed is that now the tribes, knowing the specific locations, will be required to go to those areas, dig up these ancestors specifically, and remove them so that construction can take place, while also being required to meet specific timelines, specific seasons, have certain number of individuals on the ground monitoring the survey activity, all so Enbridge can meet its construction deadlines as required as part of the permit process. And so it's been a really degrading conversation. No one seems to understand the emotional impact that this process is going to have on the tribes, because we want to honor our ancestors and we want to perform ceremony in the right way. But then you also have a company and a state agency sort of cracking the whip behind you, saying, dig faster, sit faster, get them out of the way faster so we can have construction. And it's been really dehumanizing. No one seems to value the fact that these are our relatives and that we're being forced to unearth them and remove them for a private company.
It's not hard to understand what kind of pill that is to swallow. And you said we're talking about hundreds of burial mounds. Can you give us a sense of the length of time that has been talked about for this work to be performed?
Right now, the current permit proposes two seasons. Seasons are summer. You know, you can really only do this when the weather is amiable. And so even within those summer seasons, there are a limited amount of days to actually conduct the work. And when you are excavating and really unearthing and removing these ancestors, there's not only the ceremonial aspect of it, but there's also the archaeological and respectful way that you have to process and make sure that you're collecting all of the remains that are available. And so even with a really large crew being as careful as they possibly can, it still takes days, sometimes even weeks, to fully assess a site and understand, was everything removed? Did we do this in the right way? And then the ceremony after of returning these remains back to their homelands, whether it's at Bay Mills or another tribal community. And so when you multiply that upon hundreds and hundreds of sites, there's no way it happens in two summer seasons.
The state has come to the conclusion that the tunnel Enbridge wants to build will reduce the risk of an oil spill by moving the pipeline out of open water. And Enbridge is required to come up with a plan to mitigate damage caused. Can you explain your perspective on this and what your concerns are about the fact that this project is going forward in environmental terms?
Yeah, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with the state about this as well, because everyone, even Enbridge, agrees that the pipeline should not be on the bottom lands of the lakes. And so a lot of folks see the tunnel as an adequate compromise, but that is short-sighted, and that is also solving a current problem and not solving past or future problems. And what we have seen as a result of this permit process is that no state or federal agency is looking at the cumulative impacts of the pipeline itself. So everyone's focused on the Straits. What if there's an anchor strike? What if there's an oil spill in the Straits? But we forget Line 5 has already spilled over 1.3 million gallons of oil across the state of Michigan. It has spilled oil elsewhere. Our water tributaries and our wetlands are interconnected. It has already damaged the Great Lakes. For me, the Straits is the heart attack that will kill the Great Lakes. But that doesn't mean we're not suffering damage and harm elsewhere along Line 5. That has already happened and will continue to happen in the future.
Whitney, what kinds of legal and political options remain for the community now that the state has approved the permit?
There is going to be litigation moving forward. Bay Mills Indian Community plans to both appeal the permit approval by the Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy Department. We've also appealed the permit decision previously made by the Michigan Public Service Commission, and we're awaiting a decision from the Michigan Supreme Court that could honestly arrive any day at this time. In addition to litigation, though, what happens when you go through that process is there's usually a remand that happens. And remand means it goes back to the decision makers. Perhaps there was something that wasn't taken into consideration. Perhaps there's certain evidence that should be added to the record. Perhaps there's additional evidence that needs to be collected. But our decision makers are still deciding.
Whitney Gravel is president of the Bay Mills Indian Community. Whitney, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, Chi Miigwech, thank you for having me.
We reached out to Michigan's Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy about the concerns raised in this interview. In a statement, the agency said replacing the existing Line 5 pipelines with a tunnel would reduce spill risks in the Straits, and that Enbridge is required to take steps to protect natural and cultural resources. The agency did not say how it would respond if archaeological or burial site work takes longer than expected. We're going to break here for just a moment. After that, a Democrat and a Democratic Socialist candidate go head-to-head in a big Washtenaw County election matchup.
We need to build houses for the people. Right now, the strategy and the plan is build million-dollar condos, $2.5 million condos that nobody can afford to live in.
That story's right around the corner. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Ann Arbor's incumbent mayor, Chris Taylor, a progressive Democrat, is facing a well-known challenger in the primary, Democratic Socialist Youssef Rabi, a former state representative. It could be a close election, symbolizing either a rebuke or a favorable nod to dramatic changes in Ann Arbor since Taylor first took office. Michigan Public's Tracy Samilton reports.
As he has done for 12 years now, Chris Taylor gavels Ann Arbor's city council meeting to order.
Welcome to the July 20 meeting of the Ann Arbor City Council.
Taylor and city council members have been working for years to address the cost of housing in Ann Arbor. It's especially hard for lower income people to afford to live here. One agenda item today is on the city's purchase of an apartment complex to convert it to affordable housing.
Public hearing number 6, resolution to approve the issuance of bonds by the Ann Arbor Housing Commission for Ann Arbor Housing Development Corporation, Dr. Willis C. Patterson.
Taylor is a member of city council, but as mayor, he still gets the lion's share of praise or blame for changes that are generally unanimously approved by the council. It has approved citywide rezoning to encourage housing density, and it's approved controversial high-rise buildings throughout the downtown. The fast and furious changes have siloed a sizable group of residents who don't like what they're seeing. Jim Kenyon has been a homeowner for 33 of the 42 years he's lived here.
We've seen the skyline go from U-Towers and whatever the other high-rise is called.
It's Tower Plaza. I had to look it up.
To, now you can't see across town.
Kenyon supports more affordable housing, but he thinks Taylor and the council have mostly just given tax breaks to rich developers for all those high-rises.
And whenever you have the entirety of city council just standing up and voting in lockstep with the mayor, there's a problem. That's groupthink.
Kenyon is among those who want a new mayor to slow the city's roll. That's exactly what worries James Weir, also a homeowner. There's a crying need for more affordable housing, Weir says, but he thinks mayoral candidate Yusuf Rabi's proposals are vague.
I worry that he would come in as mayor, he would stop the incremental progress that we're making. If we're going to do something different than the real meaningful progress that we're having right now, I need to know what that is.
But Yusuf Rabi says his policy ideas are workable. He says he's not against more housing density, but he calls it a trickle-down approach that can take decades to show the impact. He says the current mayor had 12 years to fix the affordable housing problem and didn't, and overall housing prices have only gone up.
We need to build houses for the people. Right now, the strategy and the plan is build million-dollar condos, $2.5 million condos that nobody can afford to live in.
One Rabi proposal is that the city build or buy houses and place covenants on them that keep the value of the houses from increasing too much over time.
We can also expand and create municipally run cooperatives on public land.
Rabi says the investments could be made without raising taxes by using revenue bonding. These bonds would be paid off from the rents from the affordable housing units. Chris Taylor says the city has already explored that idea and found it wanting.
Affordable housing rents are by their definition low. Affordable housing revenue is nowhere near enough to support new construction. That doesn't make sense. It's not serious.
Taylor also says the claim that housing prices are only going up is wrong. Rent tracking websites show the new high-rise apartments have driven vacancy rates higher, which drove rents lower by 4-6% last year. And city officials say Ann Arbor's on track to triple its number of affordable housing units in the next few years. Taylor says he's like everyone else. He misses some of his favorite places, Borders Bookstore, where he met his wife, the iconic candy and sandwich shop Drake's, where they had their first date. But here's the thing, he says. The world changes.
All successful cities change. All successful cities evolve. And Ann Arbor is no exception.
Meanwhile, no matter who holds the mayor's gavel next year, change is definitely coming to the makeup of city council. There's no incumbent running in 2 of the 5 city council wards on the ballot. And most of those wards have a candidate aligned either with Taylor or Rabi. That could mean a little less of a unanimous city council at the meetings next year. For Michigan Public News, I'm Tracy Samilton.
What exactly is that one flower you've seen in your backyard? Have you ever been plagued by that question? The University of Michigan has designed a new app that might be able to help. The Michigan Flora mobile app is our state's most comprehensive plant identification guide, and it evolved from a printed field manual of Michigan flora to a website and ultimately to an app. I'm joined now by the two guys who are in part responsible for the development of this. Tony Resnicek is curator emeritus at the University of Michigan Herbarium. Tony, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Brad Ruffel is with us, too. He's an assistant research scientist in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and is a research collection manager at the Herbarium. Brad, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Maybe, Tony, could we start with you? What are the origins of this body of knowledge about Michigan flora?
Well, the Michigan flora knowledge about it goes way back. In fact, the very first plant collection that is a documented museum specimen laying out the occurrence of a plant in Michigan, i.e. a dot on a map, dates from 1810, if you can believe that. The Flora Project dates from a beginning in 1956, after thousands and thousands of collections already were accumulated documenting the flora throughout the state. And Ed Voss, the late curator of vascular plants, worked for many decades, literally, compiling a 3-volume Michigan flora. And this was the first complete flora with identification keys and maps and all the details you'd like to have about plants. He and I, after he retired, put together a 1-volume field manual, which was meant to condense all that information. It's pretty hard to lug 3 volumes around in the woods. And so we got that out, and immediately, coincident with that, all the text and other materials like the maps were also put on the web for a website. So that was a really good beginning. And the advantage of a website, of course, is that it can be regularly updated as knowledge about our flora changes.
Did you find that public use of the website was very broad?
Yes, I think so. A lot of people used it not merely to identify plants, but to search out information about plants, because for every one of the nearly 3,000 species in Michigan, we have a discussion about its occurrence, information about whether it's native or not, what it is, a tree, a shrub, a herbaceous plant, a grass, a sedge, so forth, and typically illustrations, sometimes quite a few illustrations. And that usage continued with the website, and we were able to do a lot of illustrations, especially for popular groups like orchids, for example, and trees.
Brad, when work on the app began, what were some of the considerations that you put into building it and how people would be using this information?
Our primary goal was to make it so that you could use it on a mobile device offline, because many people refer to the dichotomous keys, which are basically a series of questions that once you answer them, you'll know what species you're looking at. And if you're not lugging the 3-volume set or the 1-volume book around in your backpack, you'd like to use it on your phone. Even if you're just on a nature walk, you often have your phone in there, but you may be walking around somewhere that doesn't have a data connection. And in that case, you can't access the website, and then you can't use the resource. So our primary goal was to have it usable offline. Primarily, it's synthesizing most of what the website can do, not everything, but most, and particularly most all of the things that you would want to have available in the field to identify a plant.
Sure. So, Tony, when you look at the app, which I am right now, how do you see this being different? What elements really stick out to you that's different from older forms of the project?
Well, the keys focus you more carefully into answering specific questions. That's really helpful. There is an option there to utilize some of the photo recognition software that's out there, where you can put out a picture of a plant and it'll suggest an identification. That's an external thing that already exists, so we didn't need to reinvent the wheel, so to speak.
I'm looking at the key right now, and okay, let's say I live near some wetlands. Let's say I want to identify my pond moss. I go in and I go into the key and tap aquatic plants, and then I have two options. I can choose plants without a distinct stem and leaves, free floating or below the surface, or plants with a distinct stem or leaves. Now, in this case, I'm thinking about the little tiny green leaflets that I see on my local pond, and I tapped it, and then it gives me another two options. So it seems like a sort of a choose your own adventure approach. Brad, is that how you describe it to people?
That's actually exactly how I describe it to people. I say choose your own adventure quite often, so.
Love it. Tony, how do you see flower and nature enthusiasts benefiting from this app?
Well, I think people, especially if they have some experience, will have an easy time starting out with the app, because they'll have some idea of where the plant belongs, and this will focus them clearly to getting a right answer. And people are always very concerned about getting the right answer. And also, there is information about the occurrence of plants. People often want to know where in Michigan it's found. Is there locality that they just located something special, or is it well known from the area, and so forth? So I think those are the two main things: getting information about the plant and focusing your identification to make sure you've got the right answer.
I just want to say that I was able, as a layperson, to get through to the common water mule, which I'm assuming is the plant that I see, because this photo looks exactly like what I see at the pond near my house. And this is handy. Like, there's a county map that shows other places in Michigan where I might find it. And sure enough, there's my county. And wow, all kinds of ways to level up my learning here about the physiognomy and the coefficient of conservatism. Brad, how does this guide, are there ways in which this guide would be helpful to botanists, people who do what you guys do?
Sure. And actually, we expect one of our main sort of group of users would be folks that work for parks departments, the Department of Natural Resources, or in particular, the Michigan Natural Features Inventory, who are tasked with monitoring rare plants in Michigan. So anybody that's doing wetland surveys, rare plants surveys, you know, this is something that they can have in their pocket now, especially if you're in the middle of the Upper Peninsula or the Northern Lower Peninsula and there's not good cell service, you can have this on your phone and use the keys. So Tony had brought up the apps like Google Lens or iNaturalist, where you can take a picture and it will suggest with some percent confidence what you just took a picture of. Those are great and have their uses, but they don't necessarily tell you why it thinks it's that plant. So we view the key will tell you exactly why. Oh, it's a shrub. It has pink flowers. The leaves are alternate and, you know, the leaves are serrate. That makes it this plant. But the Google Lens or iNaturalist won't tell you that level of detail. So we really think that this is a really good companion to those types of apps, because if you get a suggestion and it says, well, 67% species A, then you could jump into our app and go through the key and really make that final educated distinction about, oh yeah, it got it right or it didn't, because there are some species like grasses and sedges that have very small features that you need to look at that just won't be present in that photograph, and that those photograph apps will have a very hard time with those. So they're really, you know, you can use them independently, but they work really well together.
Guys, I have a controversial question. I don't know. I know that mobile apps are really the way just a lot of people live. But do you think that this presentation offers advantages beyond just a pocket guide? I heard what you were saying, Tony, that the actual bound version of this is pretty huge. But there are, you know, Plants of Michigan books that are commercially available. What do you think are the advantages of Michigan Flora?
Well, I think the primary advantage is, number one, portability. The app is portable. Number two, candidly, who under the age of 30 reads books anymore or even looks at websites? So I think this is in some ways bringing knowledge of the flora, you might say, into the digital connected age.
I would add to that list that this is free. So people that may be hesitant to buy whichever flora or ID book, they may not make that purchase, but you can download an app for free. And so we really hope that students, anybody who's even slightly interested could look at this and just check it out for free. And maybe that will spur them to get more involved in Michigan botany.
Right. Were there any other concerns that came up in terms of functionality that you worked hard to build in?
I'd say off the top of my head, there are two things. The app comes with only one photograph per plant to make it smaller for people that might have memory limitations on their phones. But in the information section, there's a download additional images link where you can download all the images from the website for each species if you have enough room on your phone. I think it says how much it takes in the app. I think it's 3.5 gigs or something like that. So if you have room, you can download many more photos, but that's up to you. And then another thing that's different in the app than the website is that as you work your way through those keys, you can run into some terminology that you might not be familiar with. And so if there's a technical term, it's underlined and you can actually click it with your finger and the definition for that will pop up. So you don't have to close where you are, go to the glossary, look up the word, remember what it says, go back, find your way back to the key. You don't have to lose your stride when you're working your way through the key. You can just click on those words that you might not be familiar with and a definition will pop right up. So that's another sort of difference in the app than the website that will help people that might not be familiar with those technical terms.
Tony Resnicek and Brad Ruffel have been talking to us today. They're both with the University of Michigan's Herbarium, and we've been talking about the app Michigan Flora. Tony, Brad, thank you so much, both of you, for your work on this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, a Poetry by Mail project that got a lot of people thinking about different ways to experience verse.
We finally did learn to print, but it was a definitely heavy political time. We were very much involved with the politics of Detroit and elsewhere, and we printed poems, I think, that reflected that, too.
That's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In 1969, poet and artist couple Ken and Ann Michalowski began the Alternative Press in the basement of their Michigan home on an old letterpress that they bought from the Detroit Artists Workshop. And for 30 years, the two of them ran this press and published original works from many, many artists and writers, including Charles Bukowski, Ann Waldman, Allen Ginsberg, and distributed their creations in manila envelopes through the mail. Today, the archives of the Michalowskis' life's work is captured in a new book, Dispatches from the Avant Garage, the Alternative Press. Earlier this year, I spoke with Alternative Press co-founder Ken Michalowski, as well as poet and scholar Rebecca Kosick, who worked with Ken on a new archival book. If you're near Oak Park in Southeast Michigan this weekend, Ken and Rebecca will be talking about the book at an event. Let's listen back to our conversation. Ken, Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Hi, it's great to be here today, April.
Ken, can you maybe set the table for us a bit and tell us about what was going on in your life and Anne's life, your lives together, I guess, in 1969, when you got the Alternative Press off the ground?
In 1969, when we started the Alternative Press, we had never printed before in our life. We had to move the press into our basement in Detroit, and had some people help us set it up. And we had about 20 minutes of instruction on how to print. And a 1,500-pound letter press with an imposing presence. And finally, we got it set up, and we learned to print sort of eventually. Later that same year, this was probably in June when we first got the press set up, by November, Allen Ginsberg came to stay with us in Detroit, and he ended up, we had a press in our basement, and he gave us a poem to print, a first edition poem, which we did print, and we did say at the first 2 years of what we were doing, we gave everything away. It said on the poem, a free poem from the Alternative Press. However, not everyone honored that. We sent the poem out to bookstores in New York, Gotham Bookmart, Phoenix Bookshop, and they were selling that poem, even though we paid the postage to send it to them for free. We were naive, realizing, oh, Allen's poem was actually worth some money. And the other thing we learned from Allen later on, he said that the Alternative Press products would outlast the auto industry. That's pretty good. We almost made it.
Yeah, that's quite the endorsement. When I look at, you know, the artifacts of what you were making at that time, and just thinking about what was happening in Detroit and Southeast Michigan, and really the United States in '69. Many, many people know the story of the upheaval of the discontent in the country. What comes up for you in terms of like what you remember about the motivating force that got you and Anne up and at it every day?
It was a labor of love with the accent heavily on the labor part. Definitely heavy political time. We were very much involved with the politics of Detroit and elsewhere, and we printed poems, I think, that reflected that too.
Rebecca, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to this project?
Yeah, so I first met Ken Michalowski around the year 2000 when I was a student at the University of Michigan, and Ken was my poetry professor. So I came to the Alternative Press first as a recipient of many of its mailings and postcards that I would pass out to my friends or tack up on the refrigerator or the bulletin board. And only later, after I did my PhD and got interested in what, as a scholar, I refer to as material poetics, so poetries that circulate with the material supports as a key component of their kind of meaning and their function, so like the postcards that the Alternative Press published. But then I got interested in what the Alternative Press had been doing from a scholarly perspective, and I realized that almost no one had written about the Alternative Press, in part because of some of these features of its publications that I was writing about. No one in the scholarly world. And poets who received these Alternative Press mailings, they mailed these postcards out. They stuck the bumper sticker poems to the backs of their cars, and then later they traded those cars in and the cars got demolished. And so a lot of the ephemeral forms that the Alternative Press printed in, they lived in the world with the subscribers, but they also, you know, sort of were lost over the years in many cases. So part of my interest as a scholar was in trying to bring up some of this history so that a new generation of readers could get to see some of the Alternative Press's publications, which now survive in archives and other places, private collections, things like that.
I am, for lack of a better phrase, absolutely zonked that you two were able to publish this book and that we are having this conversation so closely connected to what you were saying, Rebecca, material poetics, like these printed examples of poetry and thought of the time. In 2026, this internet era, when there's still a very lively discussion about what it means to commit things to print at a time when people are living their lives digitally in so many ways, and in which physical copies of written word, of music, of art seem almost more valuable in many ways than they ever have. Ken, do you want to talk at all about how you and Anne considered and discussed putting these poems on printed matter, like out into the world, like why that was important?
Sure. Anne was an artist, a painter, and I was a poet. But the press is something we did together. The press was entirely the two of us. And that's all there were. In all the years, it was just the two of us. And we put out, I think, a pretty good product over 30 years. Anne did a lot of the illustrations, which I did not do. But we both did typesetting and printing together. And I did much of the correspondence, which is always tough, you know, when you're writing to your heroes like Robert Creeley and Anne Waldman and a few other people like that, you have to write something decent. And that was always a challenge.
Ken, is there something that you would draw our attention to that appeared in the book that was especially meaningful to you to receive, you know, some of the correspondence that you've been reconsidering as you two have been putting this book together?
You know, I'm not sure that I have access to any of that. I could tell you a couple of poems that we received from people that were pretty spectacular. I would like to maybe read one or two. That's all, not many.
Please do.
Okay. A friend of ours named Jim Gustafson wrote what is probably a very warm and fuzzy poem. And Anne illustrated that one with a big Wurlitzer jukebox. The poem goes, "When I die, I just want a jukebox for a tombstone and to leave all my friends rolls of quarters."
Yes, please.
Yes, yes. And then I'll read you one final one, which is a bookmark by Gregory Marinek, And this is about as desperate as it gets. Beer's gone. Wine's gone. It's you and me again.
Oh, wow. If you're just joining us, my guests are poet and educator Ken Michalowski, who, of course, was one of the co-founders of the Alternative Press, and the poet and scholar Rebecca Cossack, who collaborated with Ken on the new book, Dispatches from the Avant Garage, which is a history of the alternative press. Ken, obviously some of these writers were people who you had long relationships with, but as you say, some of them were big asks. Do you have any sense of what worked in convincing people to just, you know, send some of their work product to you for this entirely free publication?
Well, it was only free for the first 2 years. After that, we had to make some money. Actually, I got fired from my job teaching at Shaw College. Seven of us went on strike saying, they won't fire us all. Well, that was the end of that.
Then they did.
I lost my job. We had no money. And so also we just had to, all we had to do was buy paper. We could do all the rest of it ourselves. Paper and ink was our only purchases that we had to make. So we did okay with that. I just don't know how much what we did impacted others, but it seemed to do that. When we put out something, we would get mail from other writers and some very good writers and saying they liked what we did. And sometimes they would ask if we would print something of theirs. We very seldom went out and asked people for something. It mostly just came to us.
Rebecca Cossack, I wanted to ask you a little bit about why you think the alternative press has not had the scholarly treatment before now. I mean, obviously it was a big part in terms of the movement of the anti-war dialogue that was going on in the counterculture of the time. Just a lot of people knew about it. And again, there were poems being submitted by some pretty major figures nationally and in Black poetry. How have you come to understand like the place that it occupied and also why it hasn't been more of a topic?
Yeah, I mean, many people wrote about the alternative press in the sort of literary sphere, people who were collaborators of the press. The Poetry Foundation, Emily Warren had written about the alternative press there, and newspapers around Detroit and Michigan had written about the alternative press, but it didn't make it into the scholarly record for what I think are a few reasons that I outline in the introduction of the book. One of those is that scholarship into American literary history has tended to focus on individual authors over the kind of background workers that allow poetry to come into print in the first place, right? Which include people like editors and publishers and designers and typesetters and copy editors and, layout folks. And in fact, Ken and Ann Michalowski played all these roles as they led the alternative press through their own DIY efforts. And so because they were sort of in the background is one of the reasons I think that it hadn't made it into the scholarly record, because some of these works that poets who were associated with the alternative press published, even as a result of their collaboration. So, Ted Berrigan published a book that came out of alternative press collaborations. Ed Dorn published books that came out of alternative press collaborations. Joe Brainerd had gallery shows that came out of his collaborations with the Michalowskis. And many of those things had been written about, but not with a focus on the alternative press as the instigator for this creative action and activity. But what I try to say in the book is that if you look at the alternative press and sort of take the approach from a scholarly perspective of starting with the press itself, then actually you can see their influences extending across this huge array of post-war American art and poetry. People write about how some of these poets make like sudden new aesthetic turns in their work, and they wonder why that is. Why do they suddenly turn to short form writing, or why do they suddenly start incorporating postcards? Well, I have an answer to that. And it's because they were working with the Michalowskis and the formats that the Michalowskis privileged in their work at the alternative press.
Nowadays, it's not uncommon to say get on a city bus and see like a public poetry project with a short form, printed right up there at eye level. But who are some of the adherents of postal poetry and other material forms that came out of this?
Yeah, I mean, Ted Berrigan and Alice Notley, a poet couple from the New York School, they did extensive collaborations with the alternative press. And they're two great examples of poets that really had already, of course, been working with poetry in all kinds of formats, including the intermedia formats that the alternative press prioritized. But through their extensive engagement with the alternative press, they made, you know, 500 and 1,000 original postcards, each one sort of handwritten. In the case of Alice Notley, she does collages and painting on the cards. Most of Ted Berrigan's are handwritten and include drawings, you know, for instance, from one of his sons, Anselm Berrigan appears on there. And Alice writes a little bit about them, about how the shape and the size of the cards became a consistent form for the couple, because you could only fit so much on a card. If you kept your handwriting really small, maybe you could get a sonnet on, but otherwise you might need to do a poem that's even shorter. And most of the poets who did the alternative press's multiple original series, so these unique handmade cards, tended not to just write words on the cards. They tended to do things like draw or decorate or incorporate art, visual art, as well as verbal arts onto the cards. And so you can see that they start to experiment with different strategies that are fitting in the alternative press's sort of milieu. And then they carry that work out beyond the alternative press into other things that they were publishing at the time.
Robert Creeley, who did 500 postcards, hand wrote, numbered each one, signed each one, and kept no copies of those poems at all. Whoever got that postcard got the only copy of that poem in existence. And Creeley was one of the best poets in the country at the time he was writing. And they asked him at American Poetry Review, asked Creeley how much he got paid for that. And Bob's answer was, well, if they paid me, I wouldn't have done it. Which is because we couldn't pay him enough. We couldn't pay him enough. No.
Ken, I know that you and Anne certainly would have been the first to say that nothing appears in a vacuum in terms of creative work. And the whole history of the alternative press over three decades, I'm not suggesting that you had like one thought about community over the course of it, but I did wonder if your involvement and the years that you put into this shaped your idea of creative community.
When we first started the press, our goal was to print our friends. We had a number of friends that I was part of a group of five people, Faye Kiknoswe, Donna Brooke, Jim Gustafson, and Andre Kudrescu, and me, the five of us, would get together and read each other's poems and critique them and laugh at them, laugh at the person who wrote them. But that then grew when Ginsberg came to us and gave us a poem, because then all of a sudden our wanting to print our friends became much bigger. All of a sudden our friends became Diane DePrima and Anne Waldman, and so many other great poets decided to send us things, and they also came to visit us in Detroit, which is another thing. We had people come to stay with us. Sometimes they stay with us, like Alan, for a week. Sometimes they stay for a few days. They were traveling through. Eventually, the visitors became to interfere with our being able to print because there were so many of them.
The name of the book is Dispatches from the Avant Garage. My guests today have been Ken Michalowski, the co-founder of the Alternative Press, and his collaborator, Rebecca Kosick. Thank you both so much for all the work that went into this book. It's really beautiful. And Ken, thank you for, I don't know what to say, like a lifetime's dedication to keeping poetry in our lives.
Poetry kept me alive, so there it is.
Thanks so much, April. It's been great to talk with you.
Ken Michalowski and Rebecca Kosick will be talking about their book at a Sunday event for the Book Beat in Oak Park, just a little bit northwest of Detroit. That's all for Stateside for today. Our show's producers are Ronia Cabansag, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Also producing, Mike Blank. And we need to say that our man in the chair is moving on to work with a different Michigan public department after this week. For more than 10 years, he's brought style and substance to so many of our segments. We know he's going to have a great time at his next job, but we're going to miss him a lot. Have fun on the new gig, Mike. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Our interns are Nicholas Alumkal, Isabella Jacob, Jaden Jefferson, and Yeneva Sise. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. You can find out more about us at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.